one thing I want to do. All right. Okay, this is Sierra Dahl, Municipal Sustainability and Energy Forum, and today we're going to have a call on community microgrids with some interesting people who have been involved in that. Our presenters today are Shalom Flank with Microgrid Architect, Jean Okun of Microgrid Energy, Barrett Brown, Drinker, Biddle, and Reese, and Greg Thompson, Clean Coalition. We'll start out with Shalom. Why don't you give us a couple minutes here of just introduction on what involvement you might have in that area?
Sure. So good afternoon to the East Coast, good morning to the West Coast. Since I go first, I guess I get an opportunity to define what a community microgrid is. Easiest way to do that is first to say what it isn't. So it's not a single user behind the fence kind of microgrid, like, say, a university campus or a military base. It's something that's out in the community, so that's mostly including residential, but I'd say that it could also include something like a downtown business district. But it's definitely a multi-user microgrid, and those have been the both the most promising but also the slowest to develop a sector of the microgrid market. I think one of the reasons why it's been so slow to develop is that we're lacking in the organizational models that would make it easier to implement. So in my estimation, having done feasibility studies for so many different microgrid sites, there are literally thousands of places throughout the U.S. where a community microgrid would make economic and technical sense today with existing technology, but we're lacking in those organizational forms. So I'm going to take the remaining 60 seconds of my 2 minutes to give some examples. One would be if an incumbent utility, a regulated public utility, undertakes to provide some form of premium service, greater reliability, greater integration of renewables within a defined boundary that is islandable. Unfortunately, we don't have regulations that permit that kind of differentiated level of service. So that one's difficult to do. A private, for-profit microgrid developer, I could head down that route, but in many jurisdictions, they'll run afoul of the regulations for who's allowed to sell electricity to whom and across what public rights of way, et cetera. There are opportunities for something like a homeowners association in that role. And Baird Brown might be able to shed some light on that, since I know he's done good work in that area. My favorite model is probably what I call a mini muni. Looks like a municipal utility. In many jurisdictions, munis have more regulatory flexibility than other forms for providing power. But again, we haven't seen enough of these kinds of cases to have a straightforward template to be able to replicate and achieve any kind of scale of rollout, but we all hope that will change in the years to come.
All right. Thank you very much. Jean, why don't you go ahead and give us a two-minute presentation?
Sure. Good afternoon. Thanks, Sean, for that presentation. It kind of led perfectly into what I wanted to discuss, which was the complexity, as which you described, and the nature of really non-standard microgrids relative to the community projects. And so my company, Microgrid Energy, we're a developer in the commercial space. So we come at from that angle. And as I can agree with you, that it's very difficult to navigate the waters, particularly with the utilities and the regulatory environment, and also provide the structure needed to do this. I think the good news is in the United States that we've got a number of successful states that have embraced the idea and the ability of us to use technologies such as blockchain and others that will enable us to do the community solar in a more effective manner, I think they're coming of age. And one of the areas of focus that we look at is the development of CCAs. I think that it's a community choice aggregator model, which, to your point, relative to municipalities, I think there's a real huge opportunity there. We're exploring some early stage work there, and we think that's where there's a lot of large development will come in this year and the coming years. The other good thing about it, I think, is that right now, currently in this environment, we see that we have a need for energy surety. Our grid is also antiquated, and a lot of the utilities are going through transmission and distribution upgrades as we add more intermittent energy to the grid relative to solar, and now we're able to use batteries to stabilize that energy storage. And so I think with those things coming together and low-cost capital, I think that the community-type solar projects really are going to start gaining legs and growing, and that'll be happening primarily from the existing projects that have been done and what we've learned and how we can apply it to the new systems. So our focus is on that commercial space, and we do work with companies that also are using fossil fuels, such as in the cogeneration space, which would lend itself very well for industrial applications where maybe there's a group of industrial facilities that need hot water, and they're going to share in some of that, in a loop that would allow them to also get the benefit of both electricity and hot water. So I won't say much more than that, other than the other final benefit would be to the grid. And then there's the grid side services, which I think are also very interesting for the grid operators and for the utilities, which comes in parallel with what these systems are providing. And I'll leave it at that. Thank you very much.
All right. Baird, you're up.
Sure. I agree with Shalom's definition. I thought I'd sort of go under it just briefly about what is a microgrid, because there's not always a lot of agreement about that. From my point of view, it's a local entity that's managing a significant portion of the load that's included in the members. And as we say, as Shalom says, we're talking about multiple members. And ideally co-managing their thermal and electric load and probably their water use and some other things as well, so that they're optimizing across a lot of dimensions. They're able to island in emergencies and provide resilience to their local communities, and they can, as Jean just said, participate in markets and sell services back to the grid, whether that's the wholesale grid that's run in some parts of the country by RTOs and ISOs, or just to the local utility. I would add a few words to what Shalom said about kinds of ways to approach this. I do think CCAs are interesting, although I think as a general rule they have to provide equivalent services to all their members, more or less like utilities do. Nevertheless, they make a friendly environment for a local microgrid, and they provide retail sales cover to a local microgrid. So I think there's some interesting possibilities for partnerships, remembering that the utility still owns the wires. And if there's going to be any islanding capability, you're still going to have a deal with the utility. And that may be that might be a subset of the customers in a for the energy services of one of these entities. I think there are several other interesting models. One is a cooperative. Some states, the laws for co-ops don't work well at all for microgrids. In New York, it would have to be rural. But in California, you could take four city blocks and call it a co-op. And I think that's a very interesting possible model. There are a couple of joint development models. A landlord in most states can sell electricity to its member renters or owners of its development. And the, what Shalom was referring to is that in the parks at Walter Reed, the former Walter Reed Army Medical Center, we basically set up an owner's association that will own all the wires and therefore be treated as a self-supplier for purposes of the District of Columbia utility definition and not a problem. And District of Columbia is a retail choice state. So wherever you've got a retail choice state, you can form a local retail electric supplier. It's not usually what the laws were set up to do, but there's no harm in doing it. We've done that for the Brooklyn Microgrid in New York City, for example. So there are a bunch of models that are worth following up, and it's really a question of what avenues does the local law give you, but we found there are quite a number.
All right. Greg, why don't you tell us a little bit about a couple of the projects you have going in the area of community microgrids?
Sure. Thanks, everyone. I am happy to be a part of this discussion and have been working on community microgrids for a number of years in partnership with communities and with utilities. We've done a project here in California called Hunter's Point, which demonstrated how to modernize the grid in a community beneficial way. We also had a project in New York under the New York REV sponsorship to do that in that state. As we know, the East Coast, suffered from Superstorm Sandy. The West Coast has now suffered from these fires. Puerto Rico suffered from hurricanes. And in all cases, people are taking a step back and looking at, basically energy and how it's operated. And we have to recognize, of course, that energy is critical infrastructure, and this centralized system that we've been using for 100 years is really not the right one now, and it carries multiple critical risks. It was mentioned earlier, it's aging, it's costly, it's inefficient. Extreme weather can, demonstrate the vulnerability. Cyber attacks on a centralized system, and I've worked in the software world for many years prior, and if you have a centralized system, you can bring it down and affect millions, and there's been papers written about that. And so we are really at a point where to accomplish both local and national security on this critical infrastructure of energy, we've got to get to a solution where we embrace community microgrids. We define them. They're a model that's replicable, and they are embraced by all the players, communities, municipal utilities, CCAs, and investor-owned utilities. And that gives us cleaner, more reliable and resilient, and more affordable energy. And so our definition of a community microgrid is, I'm just going to expand a little bit, is that this is a coordinated local grid area, and it's served by one or more substations. And the reason we use a substation as the area served, and in that area you can optimize local generation, you can optimize storage as a community solution. So it costs less, it provides more, and you can leverage, for example, large CNI areas next to residential to enable that whole system to be a lot more output and a lot more resilience and at a lower cost. So that's kind of our statement about how to do this. And then if you have a substation area as the definition and you're optimizing local generation, energy storage, fuel shifting, demand response, shifting the use of loads so you're reducing the peaks and you're doing local balancing. That local balancing effect gives you a ton of benefits, reducing costs to the peak management, demand charges, rates that change. You're deferring investments in transmission and in distribution, and you have cost certainty. And so our centralized system causes all these costs. A distributed model with community microgrid reduces all those costs. So we end up with this best solution of both centralized and distributed, and we're doing it in a way that's not just benefiting individuals behind the meter, but we're benefiting all of the customers within a substation area, improving the operations for utilities, improving the costs for ratepayers. And this is just something we feel should be known, welcomed, and driven forward across all communities.
Okay. One thing you didn't mention, and other people may have questions about it, so we'll just open it up to the questions on the panel, is your Sonoma, California project.
Yeah.
So anyhow, anybody that wants to ask him about that, go ahead. Or anything else right now, we'll just open it up to whoever wants to talk. Anybody?
Well, this is Baird. I just would add that I completely agree with Greg that what you're looking for going ahead is a grid that's composed of sort of microgrids, but mini grids and midi grids, and basically the resilience of the grid will arise from the ability to reconfigure and have different areas support one another in different ways. So, you know, like internet package switching, you know, if the power isn't getting to you one way, the power can get to you another way, and the different local areas, and I like the definition by substations, can help support each other. And I think that at least some states are moving more and more toward seeing those local services from microgrids to the larger grid, certainly California and New York. And interestingly, NARU just put in a filing with FERC saying, gee, we ought to do away with the requirement to have avoided cost for QFs, qualified facilities, renewables, and others, because we're moving more and more to local markets in the different utility areas that aren't in RTOs. And, you know, we're thinking of piling onto that and saying, right, you need to have more acquisition of services from your local customers.
I'd like to interject here for one second. Is there a way we could talk a lot about the problems involved with community microgrids and the solutions that people might have found to get around some of the obstacles?
I would start by saying, and then Shalom can jump in. I would start by saying that the biggest problem we have is that it's not a known entity. It's coming to us from the bottom up. You know, individual microgrids are proving their resilience and their cost benefits. And we have essentially a bunch of centralized energy generation delivered over long distances, and then we have behind-the-meter stuff. And individual microgrids are just behind the meter of a campus, if you will. And so one of the biggest barriers we have is that it's not a bright, shiny object yet. We haven't painted it and put it up there and said to people, hey, this is the best way to do this moving forward, most economical, most secure and resilient, and obviously allows for a lot of local clean energy too, which helps. So that's you know, one of the big problems I've found in a daily basis. People just don't know what you're talking about. And then I'll just add that we are planning to do a project in Sonoma County because of the fires. This is a rebuild better approach. And so we're going to take an area of Sonoma County in the Santa Rosa area, working with the CCA and with the utility PG&E, so Sonoma Clean Power and PG&E, and working with the local leadership to go back in and design this the right way and rebuild these areas or this particular area as a community microgrid, which will include energy efficiency, zero net energy, and modernize the grid and have optimal DER portfolios for the area, combining residential with CNI within a substation area. So it's a perfect model, and so we hope to be able to take that and promote it widely and point to it, as well as what's happening in Puerto Rico, by the way, to rebuild there. It doesn't have to be an island in the water to be the right model, and we're going to show that in Sonoma, and we're going to, obviously that's going to be shown in Puerto Rico and other places. So we want to take those models, those examples, and point to them as the way forward.
Greg, thank you. I think the Sonoma and Puerto Rico, too, those examples.
Would you identify yourself, please? Who's speaking?
Oh, sorry, Sierra. It's Shalom.
Yeah.
I think those are really good examples because they highlight the fact that much of what we're dealing with the grid is all hidden within sunk costs. If we were building a grid from scratch today, it's highly unlikely we'd wind up with the same degree of centralization. Even beyond the new technologies for automation, all the smart grid aspects that would, of course, be incorporated if we're building from scratch. But really, the fundamental architecture of the grid would surely be different. So when you have an opportunity like Sonoma or Puerto Rico, for new investment, then I think a microgrid approach and other approaches too really come to the fore. Those are fortunately unusual examples. We don't want to lose the grid entirely in whole swaths of territory very often. But we do have incremental investment occurring in the grid all the time. So here in Washington, D.C., we're involved with a proceeding at the PSC that's dealing with non-wires alternatives for capital investment by the incumbent utility. And we're seeing in a number of jurisdictions that these NWAs are really an opportunity to level the playing field and say, should we be putting these investment dollars into reinforcing a centralized approach, or can we get at least as good value and probably a lot of additional value streams at the same time if we go for microgrids and other kinds of decentralized approaches. So I think instituting a strong set of procedures where NWAs are examined on an equal footing with utility investments, that's one of the ways to overcome some of the sunk cost bias.
There.
Yeah, that's excellent. I just wanted to add to that because in California, there's a finally equal analysis happening at the California Public Utility Commission, comparing solar and storage against new or recommissioned peaker plants. And guess what's winning out? Solar and storage, and that's huge advancement for that.
Right, and a much smaller, but another jurisdiction, Rhode Island, has also instituted a similar kind of, every time you want to approve new capital expenditures, you first have to pass through this wicket of, well, what are the non-wires alternatives? And that's being instituted by the PUC there.
Baird, you had a comment there earlier.
Well, Greg essentially said it. I mean, I mentioned briefly, but California and New York, and as Shalom points out, Rhode Island and D.C., there are a number of PUCs that are working on these competitive non-wires solicitations. And that was the point of my mentioning the NARUC letter, that, interestingly, the sort of, I hesitate to say, right wing of the public utility regulatory apparatus is also moving toward wanting more markets at the whether those are RFPs or one-time auctions, or there's a lot of ways to structure effective markets at the utility level in and out of RTOs, because you can be in an RTO and still have a substation that needs support and needs a non-wires, and where a non-wires alternative is the best. And I guess I'd add that, frankly, California has a sort of a generic problem with the duck curve on on all the solar, and you know the clear answer is a lot of nanogrids, as it were, with storage that allows you to feed back that power at 6 or 7 o'clock at night when the new peak is and when the huge ramping requirement is.
Yeah, that is exactly right. California's rates are changing because of the duck curve, and you know now the most expensive rates are soon they're going to be in the evening ramp. And like you said, you know the only way to solve that is local balancing with community microgrids, you know, or combinations of microgrids, so that you can store that surplus solar and then discharge it in the evening and have that happen locally rather than pulling that most expensive energy off the transmission grid, which makes no sense.
How does this dovetail with utilities and the existing grids? What are the steps to move forward on that? Anybody?
This is Gene. I think it really highly depends on the utilities and their acceptance of their changing role in what's happening, because it's kind of a dichotomy. They view solar and storage as sort of the death knell of the way they sell power currently and the way they've been doing it for the last 100 years. But on the flip side, as here in California and other places, they now are becoming dependent on the solar and storage as a way to basically provide energy surety and avoid those transmission and distribution upgrades. So it's sort of a catch-22. I think that they realize they need them, but as we get to scale with microgrids in general, not just community microgrids, but as we start to do that, they start to look at how their role is changing, and I think some of them are more advanced than others, and some are willing to sort of take a bigger plunge as the states are mandated for higher amounts of renewables on the grid. I think they're going to be forced into the box, but they're not all going so pleasantly or easily into this new phase of this paradigm shift. I don't know if that's best way to describe it. So some will and some won't, I think is the easier way to say it.
Yeah, this is Baird. I completely agree. I think carrots are going to be as important as sticks. I think, you know, the real impediment in a lot of instances is the utility business model as we know it. And so there's a corresponding effort in a lot of states to rethink and decouple electric rates from volume of sales and or utility profits from volume of sales and to have incentives for within the incentive rate making scheme to advance customer interests in the ways that we've been talking about.
Yeah, this is Greg. I would just, you know, agree with everything said previously and just add one other item, which is the new incentives that are being discussed and in some cases rolled out for utilities, will compensate them for doing the right thing in terms of preferred resources, if you will, and saving ratepayer money instead of just throwing the same dollars at the same, you know, archaic way of doing things. And one of the conversations that's happening, of course, is the role of the utility changing from a typical traditional utility to one that's often called the distribution system operator or a DSO. If you hear that term, it means the utility operating the grid and getting compensated appropriately for the grid operations, but allowing obviously the procurement of energy itself to be handled by, if you will, municipal entities like CCAs, or it could be done by the utility, but it's a separate, they're not compensated for volume of energy delivered. They're compensated for operating the grid in the most efficient way and in one that is supporting the needs of sustainability and resilience.
Okay.
Greg, this is Sean.
Go ahead.
Sorry, I have one follow-up question for Greg. And by the way, I completely agree with the DSO, the analogy of going from the ISO, the transmission level, to having the utilities kind of reclaim some of their more traditional operator role at the distribution system level as a DSO. I definitely think that we're going to see more of that. But you had said at the outset something that I think may be important for a more productive utility role with microgrids in the future, that your unit of analysis, as it were, is looking at the substation, is looking at the service territory for an individual substation. And, you know, as someone who's been involved with developing a lot of microgrid projects, we often start with the end users. Their loads are what drive the project, the analysis, the design. But from a utility perspective, if you're going to fit in with the existing system, then it's whole radial feeders, entire substation territories, or specific secondary networks. That's how they run things. And if you can make the boundaries of a community microgrid coincident with those elements of their existing structure, then I think we may be able to move forward a little faster.
Yeah, no, you hit on something really important, which is the system of how the grid operates, especially focused on utilities and the distribution grid. And we worked with PG&E on an analysis, doing power flow modeling and doing DER portfolios and putting those two together. So we put the substation; it had 9 feeders. It was like 35,000 customers in the area. We put the substation architecture together with DER and said, okay, if you're going to do it at that level, what's the optimum solution for cost, for flow of energy, and not having any, voltage issues or backfeeding to transmission? And so we created a model for how to do that, and PG&E was very receptive, and they were very helpful, and they understood it. And the gist of it is, if we can go do what you said, which is go back to having utilities operating their distribution grid and being compensated for what I like to call local balancing. And if you give them that role and compensate them for that, they will look out into their substations in their communities and say, oh, if I'm pulling a lot less energy off transmission during peak times and I'm rewarded for that, because I'm saving my customers money, that means I'm going to generate energy below the substation. And you can think of the substation transformer as the meter. And you're thinking, okay, below this meter, I have a whole area where I can generate energy on the largest rooftops, the largest parking lots. I can procure that energy at wholesale. It's community solar, essentially, or community wind if there's wind available. And I can sell that to my customers at a lower cost than if I had to pull that energy off transmission during these peak times. And, of course, I can use energy storage in optimal locations to store that. And I can put storage and solar at the emergency locations, fire, police, shelters, schools, if there's a grid outage. And I can have that broken into sections, too, across my substation so that I've got smaller subsections, smaller grids within the community microgrid. And when you put all that together, it's actually a formula that gives you lower costs because you're doing solar and storage in larger increments aggregated across big areas, and you're providing that energy to everyone who is in the substation area on those feeders locally, and then storage as well. So I know I'm going on about this, but the gist is that's having that approach rewarded by the utility, and having them in the role of a local balancing authority, like we have regional balancing authorities, the ISOs. I would love to see, at the federal level or something, somebody push forward the idea that utilities should be local balancing authorities, and that gives us this economic benefit. It gives us the resilience we don't have in the centralized architecture, and it puts the utilities in that role of being the DSO.
I agree with that, Greg. That's the grid of the mini grids is our energy surety of the future, right? And that's that's how we get to the high percentages of renewable on the grid anyway. So it's all there, but just convincing them to do that federally, I think, is a big push. You know, to get to see what the grid 3.0 is, right? So.
Yeah, exactly.
We have several folks right now. No, go ahead, Baird.
This is Baird. One of the folks I represent is the Microgrid Resources Coalition, which is an advocacy group that's trying to do exactly that. So I'm happy to talk more offline with anyone who's interested.
We have several people right now who are listening to this conversation. I'd like to open it up to questions from them. But there's a few phone numbers I don't identify, so I'm going to unmute everybody, and if I read your phone number, would you please? So there's a 781-810-204. Who's that?
That's Rick Reepstein.
Oh, okay, Rick. I have your number in there. And then a 914-242-4725.
Ron Kamen.
Ron, okay. And then 707-953-2885.
Rick Brown, Terra Verde.
Hey, Rick. Super. All right, just to identify that. So anybody that has questions for these folks, please feel free to dive in and identify yourself. And, you know, if everybody's all at once, we'll just try to sort it out, take it one at a time.
This is Evan M. Hughes. I'm in on Skype.
Go ahead.
No, I kind of suspected as much, Evan, but thank you. Okay, anybody have questions here?
I have a question. This is Rick Reepstein. I'm curious, there was a lot of mention of CCA, Community Choice Aggregation. How does that actually, how do you take, if you've got a community that's done that, what's the next step towards getting that community to do a mini or a microgrid?
Well, this is Rick Brown from Terra Verde. If you're interested, I can talk about a process that we're doing with Lancaster Choice Energy, which is the CCA for a community in Southern California, and we are working with both the CCA and a local school district, which already has solar installed at 19 campuses, and the microgrid project we're looking at there is one where we will create, and with the addition of battery storage and microgrid controllers and two-way electrical vehicle charging and electric buses, we'll be setting up what we call critical resource centers at four or five different school sites. Basically they're cafeteria, gym places that have, local infrastructure, kitchens, refrigeration, space, et cetera. And they will also, because the solar is sized to the overall campus, under an outage situation, there'll be excess production that can be used to charge not only the batteries that are on the campus to keep that facility running 24/7, but excess production that can go into electric buses that can then be mobilized to go to other community essential service centers, be they a fire station, nursing home, et cetera. So that's a project that's under development that where the CCA is looking to get the benefit because they're not only a CCA, but they're also a municipality, but they're also obviously getting the benefit of the storage and the solar production in terms of a DER, grid services and load shaping play.
Okay, one thing, would people please mute their phones since they're all unmuted right now, mute their own phones. And go ahead, next person.
Hi, Rick, this is Gene. Actually, that's an awesome project, it sounds like. I'd like to hear more about that. Quick question for you relative to that. Since Lancaster is the CCA, and they're going to have to obviously have their own funding for that, was it difficult for you to work through financing this this particular project for them, or was it just as simple as they were able to self-fund it?
Well, this is one of those, like every other one, that has a complicated funding scheme. The batteries that are going to go into the schools actually being paid for under California's Prop 39 program, which provides funding grants to schools to do energy saving projects. We've also applied to the California Energy Commission under a special EPIC program. So we don't know whether we're going to get that funding for some of the supplemental costs. If we don't, we'll be working with the with LCE to look at other ways to finance the, you know, the batteries are paid for, the solar is paid for, microgrid controllers, electrical work, two-way chargers. That we'll have to come up with some incremental funds some other way. We believe that we'll be able to do that because of the value stack revenue that we'll be able to demonstrate and the load shaping, you know, benefits for the CCA. But hopefully we'll get the research grant to get it off the ground initially.
That's awesome. Are they also providing other services like frequency VAR control or anything like that to the utility as another?
That's the plan. You know, the plan is to be able to deploy the system for as many potential revenue streams as possible. But, you know, that to be determined. But this is still very much, just to be clear, this is very much we're in the pre-development phase where we've got the concept, we've got the proposal, we're waiting to get the approvals of either this research money to fund some of this stuff, or we'll go out and shop it and work it in other ways.
Sure. Thank you.
Anybody else?
This is Evan. A question about the compatibility of the requirement. I heard early on something about a requirement that you'd be able to island the microgrid, and that would not seem to be the case for a substation area. Is there a conflict there, and how resolved?
Yeah, that's a good question, and this is Greg. Let me start by saying the design we did in New York included storage at the substation or near the substation, and it included storage at the critical locations. And so what we ended up with was a design that allowed for the transmission grid to go down and the entire substation area would, with the storage at those both locations, would be able to provide electricity to both critical and priority loads. So that's essentially an islanding of the whole substation area, but everyone should understand that when we say islanding, we mean that only a subset of the loads are served. It's critical loads and then hopefully some priority loads as well. And that all depends on calculating, of course, how much energy storage you're going to have and how much you're going to reserve for when the grid goes down. In addition to that, we had, of course, storage sprinkled around at these critical sites so that if the distribution grid went down, let's say, you know, somebody smashed into a pole, you also had islanding of sections of the distribution grid so that you could serve those critical loads and priority loads in those subsections of the substation. So you kind of have a double layer, if you will, of serving critical and priority loads depending on the emergency situation, whether it's transmission that goes down or whether something happens in the distribution grid itself.
Yeah, this is Baird. I was the one who raised the question about islanding, and that is that's probably, like Greg says, it's probably a neater idea when you're talking about a single campus or single customer microgrid. However, it's an important feature. And what's really important, I mean, when you think about even a campus or a customer islanding, is that what microgrids are good at is intelligent load management and intelligent load shedding. So what Greg was describing is essentially getting better and better and more granular at being able to support loads that are critical for one reason or another, whether that's, you know, an industrial process or research on a campus where there's 30 years of research that goes down the drain if the ice cores melt, or whether it's the police station or the fire station. So there, it's sort of doing that planning process within the appropriate geographic context, whether that's immediate and tiny, or whether it's at the substation level, and being able to intelligently manage the load to your ability to serve it locally.
So this is Shalom, and there's some tricky things about doing that load management when you're talking about community microgrids. If you're talking about a campus like UCSD, you want to protect those ice cores. The whole electrical system is under the control of a single entity of the campus facilities department. And they can turn off entire circuits, buildings, et cetera, in order to serve just the critical load. When you're talking about community microgrids, you don't have that single entity. The utility given today's extent of distribution automation doesn't have that ability either. They can't shed individual loads. They're gradually improving their sectionalization ability, as Greg was saying. So sometimes you can, shut down a feeder or even a chunk of a feeder, but you don't have the granularity to differentiate between critical and non-critical loads if you only have a certain amount of power within that substation area or on that feeder and so forth. You really need the cooperation of the individual end users to put in the equipment or use their existing building management systems, et cetera, and to agree to shed the load if you wind up in that outage situation or a couple different outage scenarios, as Greg was talking about. For example, we were involved in designing a microgrid for the Hunts Point area in the Bronx, where they have the food distribution centers and wholesalers and so forth. And the design would have enough power for the big cooperative markets, but not for the individual wholesalers. And the Con Ed service to that peninsula is relatively straightforward to sectionalize. Everything comes through the neck of the peninsula. There's one point where you can control that power flow. But once you're out on the peninsula, if Con Ed tried to install the equipment to cut off those other loads in order to perform that load balancing mission for an islanded system during an outage, the cost would be through the roof. But if you got each of the individual end users to do it using their existing equipment on their side of the meter, then it's manageable. You have to give them the incentives to do it. So it's a tricky business when you get into the multi-user community microgrid side.
Any comments?
Is there an option for combining this with a demand response aggregation program?
Yes,
that's right.
Part of the process we went through with the design we did in New York was doing a RFI from the microgrid controller community. So the companies that develop the software and the automation that does controls for microgrids responded, and we got a couple of responses that clearly spelled out their capability of working with on-site building management systems or working with the on-site electrical systems to control the shedding of non-priority loads in an outage scenario, whether that outage was local or transmission. So it is not practiced today, but it is possible because the software and the electrical systems are capable of enabling it, provided like you were saying, some of the demand response automation systems can also do that kind of thing. They're basically doing shedding load in a peak, moment to get demand response going. So it's possible. The capabilities are there. It's a matter of kind of putting it into a package that says, this is what we want to do in this area, and then here's why, folks. Here's why it matters, and getting people to agree to it.
So what a community microgrid, this is Baird again, looks more like is than one big centrally controlled thing. It has a lot more distributed control, which is something that the utilities need to start investing in. And it looks more like raisin bread than it looks like a homogeneous, you know, the bigger you get, the more you get little areas of local control. But the if you look at the pathways, deep decarbonization pathways project, numbers on investment for getting to meaningful impact on climate change, it's way in excess. The investment in new technologies and new clean generation needs to be way in excess of what the current spend is from both independent power producers and utilities. And so looking to the local customers who have their own incentives, their own reasons for being able to island, their own reasons to be able to manage their own load locally, and will invest in these things for their own purposes and then be able to provide grid services at a lower cost because the full capital cost isn't just being amortized by the grid, is where we have to go to achieve those objectives.
Anybody else?
Sierra, this is Ron Larson. Can I jump in?
Good. Good.
Yeah, I've been involved in solar for 45 years and greatly impressed by everything I've been hearing here. This area has moved ahead a lot further than I thought. Much of my work has been on total energy or combined heat and power. So the word thermal energy came up early, but I haven't heard it since. I wonder if people could talk about that a little bit. But for the last 10 years, I've primarily worked on carbon negativity, and it seems to me that utilities are going to have to get into the carbon negativity business. By far the cheapest that I've found is biomass, which also is probably by far the largest source of stored energy, cheap stored energy in biomass. So I guess the only place that I know has done anything on this is Stockholm. They've done all these things. They do have combined heat and power. They do have biochar. Any comments?
Ronnie, this is Gene. I guess I could comment on the thermal side because I've done some cogen, but I think relative to the community side of the solar business, relative to how you manage thermal energy in a loop, like you said, there's very few instances that I'm aware of. Maybe the city of Toronto, they are using a large thermal loop to cool that from the lake and heat the whole city through that kind of a method. The other way that I could see a potential way to do that would be in the radial type of a microgrid where you have a number of industrial users that all need thermal energy, and you have sort of a little microgrid in the middle there that has a centralized combined heat and power in the block. You know, maybe some carport solar, and then a battery for some of the frequency and critical loads. And essentially, you would be able to, you know, provide a thermal loop to the users in an ideal world, and they can offtake that thermal energy, as well as all the other benefits of having maybe an engine that's got a spinning reserve also on site, which would allow for, I think, the utility to use that at will. So I think there's opportunities, but I think it's not that easy to co-locate the thermal side of it, unless there's a use that's, you know, in the industrial side that's needed. Or if you build a home community. Yeah.
Sorry, Gene. Go ahead.
Well, if you built a home community from scratch like that, I think you could also do a similar thing where you had a centralized thermal loop and everybody gets to share off of that, and then tying that to a microgrid that would be able to use a combination of solar and battery and even cogen.
Okay.
So this is Baird. There's a sort of a couple of different divisions here. There's an awful lot of interest in cogeneration-focused microgrids in the Northeast and Midwest, places where there are larger thermal swings than California, and where California has sort of taken the lead on eliminating not only coal from their fleet but natural gas. So they're really looking harder at solar, and they've got more of it. But there are lots of examples. The city of St. Paul has a combined heat and power district heating and cooling system that's largely biomass. That's the municipal utility. And there are lots and lots of campus systems and more legacy downtown systems for combined heat and power, but there's certainly a lot of them out there. If you want to check into the International District Energy Association or particularly its Campus Energy Conference, you'd meet lots of folks who are going down those paths.
Awesome. Thank you.
All right. We have a couple more minutes left, and I just wanted to mention that at some point in time we'll have Devin Hughes and Ronald Larson conference call talking about biomass, and what Ron was talking about is about to deal with biochar. So we'll have a call on that. And anybody that else has any background in that area, would you want to contact me so we can include you in the call? And we have room for probably about one more question.
This is Evan. I didn't get the connection of the biomass to the storage capability. I usually just think of biomass as stored solar energy or because of the material in the plants. But are you talking about storing biogas, or what's the mechanism of storage in your example?
No, your first response. Biomass to later be combusted is already stored energy.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, well, we have a webinar coming up in a couple of days where Greg Thompson is going to be talking about community microgrids in good detail and discussing the Sonoma project and a little bit about the work they've done in New York and different types of community and microgrids. So please take a look at your information there. And we'll have another call next week. I'll be sending invitations out to that probably tomorrow. And everybody, thanks for coming. It was a good conversation. And hope to see you next time.
Thank you.
Thanks, Sierra.
Great. Thank you, Sarah.
Thanks, Sierra.
Thank you, Sarah.